From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Pope visits South Korea, urges peace and stability in Asia. India emerges as largest foreign customer of U.S. arms. Indonesia clamps down on support for Islamic State jihadists. These stories and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Pope Francis said dialogue and not fruitless displays of force will help bring peace to the Korean Peninsula as he began a five-day visit to South Korea. Francis met with South Korean President Park Geun-hye after arriving in Seoul Thursday, and the two leaders gave a joint address. Speaking in English, a rarity for the Spanish-speaking Pope, Francis said diplomacy is based on dialogue rather than accusations and threats, and noted that Korea's quest for peace affects the stability of the entire region. President Park said North and South Korea should get rid of fear and nuclear weapons and concentrate on reunification. She thanked the Pope for his prayers and for carrying out a mass for peace and reconciliation during his visit. As Pope Francis's plane was landing in Seoul early Thursday, North Korea fired the first of five projectiles into the Sea of Japan. While traveling through Chinese airspace on his journey to South Korea Thursday, Pope Francis sent a message to President Xi Jinping, extending his best wishes and invoking divine blessings of peace and well-being on the nation. It is the first time a pope has been permitted to fly over mainland China. The Vatican and Beijing have no diplomatic relations. The main roadblock to improving ties is China's naming of bishops through the state-sanctioned Chinese Catholic Patriotic Association without papal consent. Anthony Lam of the Hong Kong-based Holy Spirit Study Center, which monitors the Catholic Church in China, told Daybreak Asia's Victor Beatty that Francis was simply following protocol.
It's a very common gesture. It's a normal practice they did and they are doing on any journey or passing over any countries.
Is this surprising, given that he's talking to a communist government?
It's very normal, quite standard to some extent. He has to say these things to address to the head of the state first, that means the President Xi Jinping now, and then to the people.
Was there a message behind the message? In other words, is he trying to improve relations?
Nothing special. I tell you one thing, is that the last time when John Paul II asked approval for flying over China to South Korea, China rejected. And then on the way back, he has to fly over the area of Taipei control. So he has to send a message to the Taipei government as a gratitude for their arrangement.
Do you think relations between the Vatican and China are improving?
In this case, it's a good thing. You see that both sides consider the need of the other side, but it's not very significant. And geographically speaking, South Korea is quite too close to China. The northern side and the eastern and the western side are totally surrounded by China. So if you're flying from west to South Korea, the best way, the most suitable way is passing through China.
I understand you have some contacts inside China with the Christian community there. One report says there are more than 50 million Christians in China. Is that an accurate figure?
Christians, maybe, altogether, the Catholic and the Protestant, maybe. So our last year's estimation is still 12 million.
Do they have any more freedom now than they did in the past?
Compared with 1980s, it's far better nowadays, but compared with in 90s or year 2000, this few years is under severe watching, we use the term, They may not be under detention, but the church is always under watching. You know, it's a pretty day when China are getting rich. They have more money to build up a watching system, controlling over your iPhone, your internet, and they can hire more people.
Are there more churches today in China than in the past?
Nowadays, yeah, that's true.
Are these official or underground churches?
Both sides are growing. We can say that the government sanctioned the church have building more churches. You know, religious freedom is sometimes a very delicate thing. It's not only you build a church, sometimes it's still talking about how you freely practice faith belief.
The Pope will spend 5 days in South Korea, the first visit to the country since Pope John Paul II made the journey in 1989. The last papal visit to Asia was 15 years ago. Francis is also scheduled to visit the Philippines and Sri Lanka. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says resolving competing territorial claims in the South China Sea is about respecting international law and not about rival claimants trying to intimidate each other. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports that Secretary Kerry spoke in Hawaii at the end of a week-long trip to Asia.
Secretary Kerry says disputed mineral and fishing rights in the South China Sea underlie more fundamental legal questions of sovereignty and rights of free passage.
You know, they're really about more than claims to islands and reefs and rocks and the economic interests that flow from them. They're about whether might makes right or whether global rules and norms and rule of law and international law will prevail.
This is one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, where China's Coast Guard already has clashed with vessels from both Vietnam and the Philippines. Indonesia, Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan also have competing claims in the South China Sea, where Kerry says a constructive U.S.-China relationship will contribute to stability.
President Obama has made it clear that the United States welcomes the rise of a peaceful, prosperous, and stable China, one that plays a responsible role in Asia and the world, and supports rules and norms on economic and security issues.
Kerry says Washington wants to avoid the trap of strategic rivalry with China. But China over the weekend helped undercut U.S. efforts to freeze provocative actions in the South China Sea, further eroding Washington's so-called pivot of diplomatic and military resources, says American Enterprise Institute analyst Michael Oslin.
Look at the way that the waterscape in Asia has changed. Look at China's increasing coercion, bordering on aggression right now. You're not doing anything about that. And yet, at every turn, at every occasion, you remind us about how important the pivot is to you. I just think people don't know what to make of it.
With the Philippines and Vietnam looking to Washington for help, American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett says China is pushing U.S. allies to the point where Beijing believes Washington will show the weakness of its Asia policy by failing to come to their aid.
It's a really focused, determined strategy based on assumptions that the United States is not really going to put its military wherewithal into the South China Sea to fight China over issues that it doesn't really care about.
A perception that she says hurts Washington at a time when Beijing and Moscow see a greater common cause.
The concern about U.S. policy has been pushing Russia and China together now for a few years, particularly since the start of the Arab Awakening over Libya, over Syria. We've been seeing them push coming together more and more, especially on hydrocarbon issues.
Kerry says the Obama administration is working to raise trade and investment standards in Asia because he says national interests are advanced not just by troops or by diplomats, but by entrepreneurs and by good corporate citizens. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
The United States was India's largest arms supplier in recent years, dislodging Russia as New Delhi's principal source of weapons. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, India has emerged as the world's largest arms buyer in recent years, but hopes to reverse this by strengthening its domestic defense industry.
India's defense minister, Arun Jaitley, told Parliament that India bought arms worth nearly $5.5 billion from the United States in the last 3 years. That surpassed purchases from Russia worth about $4 billion in the same period. Rahul Bedi at IHS Jain's Defense Weekly in New Delhi says more deals with Washington are in the pipeline.
There are two contracts for helicopters, for attack helicopters and heavy lift helicopters, which the U.S. has secured over Russian platforms. They were pitted against Russian helicopters, and that's worth another about $2.5 billion. So the American kitty seems to be growing.
In recent years, India has been trying to diversify its arms purchases to move away from its huge dependency on weapons from Moscow, its Cold War ally. New defense deals with the U.S. are expected to focus on projects that will transfer production and technology know-how to India As New Delhi tries to boost local production of high-technology weapons, the government last week raised foreign investment in the defense sector from 26% to 49%, hoping to woo foreign arms manufacturers. India's failure to build a domestic military industry has made it the world's top buyer of weapons. But Prime Minister Narendra Modi says the country must lower dependence on imports. On a recent visit to India to deepen military cooperation, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel indicated that the U.S. is willing to move from buying and selling arms to co-production and co-development. Rahul Bedi says freer exchange of technology will benefit India.
This has been an area of great contention between India and the U.S., but the recent visit of the U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel outlined about 10 technologies which they were willing to transfer to India and technologies that India is in need of. But nothing has been concluded, and still there's a lot of negotiation left. But it seems that the U.S. is more amenable to transferring technology to India, and that is good for India's local industry.
Among the weapons on offer for technology sharing is the anti-tank Javelin missile. The U.S. has called it an unprecedented offer. Defense analysts say the U.S. has increased its presence in India's defense market due to two reasons. Despite some ups and downs, strategic relations between the two countries have improved, as India is seen as a counterbalance to China. Also, in the last two decades, analysts say Russia has become an unreliable supplier, often missing deadlines and raising costs. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
As the jihadist insurgency in Syria and Iraq intensifies, so too does its appeal to hardline Islamists in the world's largest Muslim-majority nation. As Kate Lamb reports from Jakarta, the Indonesian government has moved swiftly to crack down on the possibility of a revived terrorist threat.
On the streets of Jakarta and across pockets of Java, small groups of hardline extremists have openly pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State extremist group. Thousands more have mimicked their cries on social networking sites. And from maximum security prison, hardliner preacher Abu Bakr Bashir has also pledged an oath to the newly declared Islamic Caliphate, photos of which have circulated online. The Indonesian government has moved to swiftly crack down on the developments, earlier this month officially banning the group and the spread of its teachings. The government says the hardline group, formerly known as the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, contradicts Indonesia's pluralist state ideology, Pancasila, and that it will block websites displaying its content. Sri Yunanto from Indonesia's National Counter-Terrorism Agency told a panel discussion on Wednesday that it is stepping up efforts to curb the threat of Indonesian fighters returning from Syria, what he described as jihadi alumni.
We have to be prepared when the issue of ISIS in the Middle East is over and then they come back into Indonesia. We have experience with the issue of Afghan fighters, Moro fighters. We don't want that the ISIS graduate, if I may say, ISIS alumni in Indonesia and Iran will be like them.
Key individuals behind major terrorist attacks in Indonesia, such as the 2002 Bali bombings, received direct training with MILF, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in the Philippines, and in Afghanistan in the late 80s and early 90s. Over the past decade, Indonesia has successfully dismantled hardline groups such as Jamaah Islamiyah, and most senior hardliners have either been killed or incarcerated. For would-be Indonesian jihadis, the Syrian conflict represents an appealing training ground, one where they can gain weapons and bomb-making skills and develop contacts with a well-funded terrorist group. Taufik Andri, the executive director of the Institute of International Peacebuilding, says that in Indonesia's current terrorism landscape, it is the splinter or freelance jihadists that pose the biggest threat.
Mostly, the Indonesian jihadis are driven by the individual motivation, not necessarily by groups or leaders' command. They got enough information from the internet, from the Facebook and Twitter, and that's enough for them to decide. Freelance jihadi individuals This is just a matter of money.
The government believes that up to 30 Indonesians have joined the Islamic State in Syria, but analysts say the figure could reach 200. Porous borders and poor coordination between agencies and ministries has allowed some individuals to buy tickets to Turkey and then cross the border into Syria undetected. Even though the numbers of Indonesian fighters joining the conflict in Syria are small, Todd Elliott, a Jakarta-based terrorism analyst from Concord Consulting, says returned jihadis pose a significant security threat in the long term.
I don't think there's an immediate threat of jihadists returning and immediately using any skills they had to launch a terrorist attack. But the fact that they have these skills and they're available and they can pass it on to younger jihadists and other groups, that's where the risk lies.
Indonesian authorities have threatened to revoke the citizenship of individuals who continue to support the Islamic State and say they will better monitor its citizens travelling to the Middle East in the near future. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
Living with a terminal illness is a death sentence of unparalleled dimension, but there are stories of how those afflicted can still enjoy life in remarkable ways. Daybreak Asia's Ray Kugel takes us to the movies this week and tells us about a documentary showing how a Cambodian teenager makes it happen.
Vin is a 15-year-old Cambodian boy who is suffering from arsenic poisoning. It came from drinking contaminated well water in his home village of Prek Rusay. A documentary called Born Sweet shows Vin is not alone. His father, grandfather, other relatives, and villagers have it too. Vin started feeling the effects when he was 10. Spots on his body, diarrhea, vomiting, and coughing, and there is no cure. Mother Nature is to blame. Volcanoes in the Himalayan mountains thousands of years ago cursed the soil with its arsenic deposits and saw it wash down the Mekong River. There is no color, taste, or smell. But Vin is no ordinary young man. He thinks about death and accepts his fate philosophically. As he explains in his own words, "Salty people are strong, sweet people are sickly." Vin is one of the sweet people, even though his village now has wells where the water is safe to drink. The damage is done. It is by an uplifting fascination with karaoke music and a dream to become a star that Vin makes his daily troubles go away. The dream is realized when he gets a chance to make a karaoke video about ways to prevent arsenic poisoning. Through the help of Resource Development International, a community health care and education program focused on water and sanitation. Sweet is more than just a contemplative film about how someone so young copes with such a drastic illness. It is an often stunningly beautiful piece of work cinematically, filled with scenes of lush, rural Cambodian countryside, richly complementing the larger story of fate and destiny. Born Sweet is directed by Academy Award-winning director Cynthia Wade. I talked with Wade, who is based in the northeastern U.S. state of Massachusetts, about what impact making the documentary had on her and how it came together.
I tend to make films where I want to find strong main characters and go deep as opposed to telling a story of a whole village or a whole society and go wide. So in my mind, in my kind of fantasy mind's eye, I thought I would love to be able to find villagers are affected and perhaps even tell the story through the eyes of a child or a teenager. And it wasn't until we arrived in the village of Precrucet. It was an incredibly beautiful village. So beautiful, and yet was so blighted by the well water. The wells had been dug deep and near the arsenic deposits, and people were very visibly sick from arsenic poisoning. And through the interpreter, started talking to villagers, and I kept asking, who else can I speak to? Are there any children? And then one woman said to me, my nephew. And when Vin appeared, I knew instantly I could focus the whole film around him and really tell the larger story of arsenic through his eyes.
How does Vin cope with arsenic poisoning on a daily basis?
Well, the good news is he's better now than he appears to be in the film. He's gotten stronger. Arsenic never leaves your system, and the deleterious effects on your body do remain. So it's not anything you can get rid of. But you can, at least through drinking clean water moving forward and eating as balanced as a diet as possible, which is very, very difficult, obviously, for many rural Cambodians, you can at least gain some strength. And with Vin, his body was so beaten down. He had worms in his lungs. It was hard for him to breathe. He had a bad cough. And once he got on medicine for that, then he felt stronger and had a better appetite as well. But it is an ongoing struggle for millions of people throughout Southeast Asia, particularly in Cambodia and Bangladesh.
How do Vin and his father get along as fellow sufferers with such dire consequences awaiting them?
My experience of Vin's father was that he was very sad and quite depressed, and that it was very, very difficult for him to see his village sick and particularly his child sick. There was a dark cloud over the village and over his father, and I think it was very, very sad for his father to turn and see Vin, particularly when Vin was struggling to breathe and was coughing heavily.
After it was all over, what was Vin's reaction to the film?
He loved it. We screened it. He was so proud of being in the karaoke video, and that was a really, really fun and big shoot that we did at the end. I think about Vin and his family, his siblings, and some of the other kids in the village every day. Honestly, it was such a sweet time for me and for my crew, too.
Looking back now, how did the filming affect you?
It was one of the rare times in my career where I was able to make a film kind of for me and to really tell a story the way that I wanted to tell a story that was kind of fictionalized and proactive as opposed to reactive. And that has helped me think about storytelling in a more visual way. Cambodia is inside me now, and I feel like it's the place I think about the most when I'm not thinking about my present moment and my present work.
Wade's short documentary offers a deep appreciation of what someone can do against insurmountable adversity. Born Sweet is an inspiring piece that does not preach. Through the story of a young Cambodian, you learn the importance of truly enjoying the moment, no matter how dire the circumstances. Born Sweet is the winner of 15 Independent Film Awards, all well-deserved. I'm Ray Kugel.
To view the film, you can go to your favorite search engine and type in Born Sweet, and you'll find it on Vimeo.com. Our thanks, as always, to Ray Kugel and also to Daybreak Asia director Tracy Carter, who does all that wonderful production work each week on our movie features. It's always worth a second listen, and you can on our website at voanews.com. The latest world news is also worth a listen. Stay tuned. Steve Norman is next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Listen to Today in History, weekdays on the